And the Treasurer has spoken. Wayne Swan said this would be a no-frills budget. Did he deliver on that? What does it do for the country and what does it do for the government's economic and political credibility? We'll be looking at all of that and who wins and who loses over the next hour. But for a wrap of what was announced tonight, we begin with the news presented by political correspondent Louise Yaxley.
The return to surplus is the main feature of Treasurer Wayne Swan's third budget. He's forecast a $1 billion surplus in 2012. He says that's ahead of any other major advanced economy.
The key achievement here is delivering on a strict fiscal strategy that brings us back to surplus in 3 years and 3 years ahead of schedule.
He's delivered the promised no-frills budget, free of election year extras. Instead, he's highlighting the improvement on last year's gloomy forecasts, when the jobless rate was expected to peak at 8.5%. But now it's already on the way down, and is forecast to be 4.75% by the middle of 2012. The recovery is built on the booming mining industry and the best terms of trade in 60 years. So the economy's forecast to grow at 3.25% next year and then 4%. Getting the budget back into the black relies on that growth, but also savings measures and new taxes, particularly on tobacco and mining company super profits. Wayne Swan says it's a budget that's light on politics and big on policy, but it does include a simpler tax return system and the promise of easier access to GPs. Danny Morgan has those details.
Early in his speech, Wayne Swan confessed that this was a budget different to most pre-election budgets. There were no new tax cuts or any increases to family benefits.
It's not about the political equation. What it's about is putting a budget in place that's right for the times.
He says the budget will help ease the cost of living for working families. From 2013, millions of Australians will be able to save time and money for filling in their tax returns. Instead of sorting through endless receipts and hiring an accountant, taxpayers can choose a standard $500 deduction rate for work-related expenses. When the benefits of that change are combined with previously announced tax cuts and a new tax discount on savings, a person earning $50,000 will be about $850 better off. Mr. Swan says families will also benefit from better health care. The budget will fund 23 new GP superclinics and upgrades to hundreds of existing surgeries. There's $390 million to help doctors hire extra practice nurses. And the government will set up a new national helpline so families can get after-hours advice from doctors and nurses. To address a looming skills shortage, the budget will fund 70,000 new training places and provide support for 22,000 apprentices. The government is paying for the major spending initiatives with the increase in tobacco excise and the proposed mining super profits tax. But as Naomi Woodley reports, there are also cuts across a range of departments.
The delay to the emissions trading scheme gains the government $650 million over 4 years, but that's all being redirected into a new renewable energy future fund. Tightening work rules for the disability support pension will reap almost $390 million over 4 years, and a lack of demand for the green car innovation fund means it's being downsized by $200 million. $1 billion will be saved over 4 years by a change in the way Australia's international aid funding is calculated. And $86 million is being clawed back in returning a cap and making changes to the childcare rebate. There are cuts to the customs budget for monitoring illegal fishing in the Southern Ocean, and funding for grey water and desalination projects is being reduced. The government has also abandoned plans to fill 4 places on the Family Court and Federal Magistrates Court, saving $10 million. A range of other programs have been trimmed or abolished, and there's no funding for major defence programs like a new generation of submarines. The Finance Minister, Lindsay Tanner, says in total, $1.2 billion has been saved through greater efficiency in government departments. Now back to Louise Yaxley for an overview of the main points.
Wayne Swan's budget centrepiece is a surplus of $1 billion in 2012. Unemployment's on its way down to 4.75% and economic growth is predicted to be 4% in 2011-12. Strict spending rules mean few new announcements, but there's a promise that in 3 years, taxpayers filling in a tax return will be optional. There are also more GP super clinics and practice nurses. The government's third budget's built on the booming economy, new taxes and trimming in most portfolios. Back to you, Eleanor.
Thanks, Louise. Well, the contrast with last year could hardly be more stark. Then the spectre of the Great Depression hung over the budget process, and the government said it had to spend up to keep Australians in work and out of the global quagmire. This year, the Treasurer says he has a spring in his step. Wayne Swan is pitching his 2010 budget as building on the government's successful economic management and putting down foundations for future prosperity. He promised significant new money for health, for savings, tax breaks and for defence, as we've been hearing, but he stressed that this is a responsible budget without bells and whistles, with only modest pre-promised tax cuts and with every dollar of government spending accounted for. Although the opposition will be sure to point out that a lot of that is thanks to the resources profits tax at its centre. And despite the no-frills packaging, there was a surprise, a return to budget surplus in just 3 years. This is Mr. Swan's third budget, but it's also his first election year budget. And the government will want to help build its image as economically responsible, while it paints the opposition as a risky proposition. But don't call it an election budget. The Treasurer Wayne Swan may have been delivering his 2010 budget just months out from a federal election, but tonight he was adamant this budget is about policy, not politics. But will it put a floor under the government's sliding popularity? We'll be speaking to the Treasurer, the Shadow Treasurer and a panel of experts to help you assess whether or not this is a responsible budget and just what it will mean for you and for the Australian economy and indeed for the political fortunes of the government and the opposition as we head towards an election. Our Chief Political Correspondent Lyndall Curtis begins our coverage.
Everything you need to know about what the government wants you to take away from this year's budget was in the seventh paragraph of the Treasurer's budget speech. Tonight, he said, the government meets the highest standards of responsible economic management, returning to surplus in 3 years, 3 years ahead of forecast, and a much smaller debt than predicted. And it's fighting the ever-worsening opinion poll numbers with the numbers in this budget's bottom line. With the Prime Minister's support plummeting, dragging Labor down with him, the Treasurer is playing to the one strength insiders keep pointing to. Labor is ahead on economic management. And that's where he wants it to stay. The language of doom and gloom that characterised the global financial crisis has passed. Australia has weathered the downturn in good shape. Even Treasury admits it was too pessimistic about the impact. And as China grows in double digits, the Treasurer is promising happy days are here again, or hereabouts. An earlier surplus, a growing economy, unemployment much lower than forecast, a return to what's considered full employment, coupled with a mining boom bigger than Peter Costello's. Wayne Swan talks about what the government did to keep the Australian economy afloat, but he's standing on the shoulders of previous governments. Of the four things Treasury says help save Australia, financial reform, flexible labour markets, the stimulus, and China's appetite for Australia's resources, Wayne Swan can take sole credit for just one, the stimulus. So he has thank you notes to send. While the budget points to risks in the global economy from the continued instability in Europe, it's also talking about the risks on the upside. And the Treasurer has to manage risks on the upside at home as well. As revenue flows into government coffers once more, mining investment, housing and housing consumption are predicted to grow. And some spending in this budget is aimed at subduing the inflation dragon before it has a chance to stir. Money for skilled workers and infrastructure as the higher speed of the two-speed economy takes off. The government promised a no-frills budget, but not an austere one. It's keeping the lid on spending, and it's paying for its promises, but it's not slashing spending. The stimulus spending is unwinding, and it will be the private sector in the driver's seat of economic growth. The government's already upset the mining industry with its resources rent tax, but it's not upsetting ordinary Australians, and they are the votes that count. They get the final round of tax cuts promised in the 2007 election, better access to doctors and nurses, their own electronic health record, lower tax on bank accounts, and the delivery of the long-awaited promise to virtually do away with tax returns. Governments these days don't get a lot of credit from the electorate for big budget giveaways, so the low-frills budget makes a virtue of not going down that path and addressing instead a likely opposition election campaign fought on debt, deficit and wasteful government spending, with better numbers on the debt and deficit and a continued cap on real spending growth. And if it works for the budget, there might just be a low-frills election campaign to come.
Lyndall Curtis there on the politics of the budget. Now economics correspondent Stephen Long analyses some of its key economic measures and forecasts.
It's not quite the Kmart budget, cutting the cost of living, but it could ease the squeeze a little. There's a boost for the thrifty, with a halving of the tax you'll pay on interest of up to $1,000 earned on bank deposits. At current interest rates, that should mean people with up to about $20,000 in the bank get a tax break on all the interest they accrue. Helpful for people saving to buy a home and for low and middle income earners who've managed to put away some cash. There's the choice of filing a simplified tax return with an automatic $500 deduction for work-related expenses, rising to $1,000 in 2013. That'll allow many people to get a decent deduction while avoiding the expense of paying a tax accountant to do the return for them. But aside from those measures and the last of the tax cuts previously announced, the budget is largely free of the vote-buying handouts we've come to expect in election years. Not a fistful of dollars budget, and not an austere one either. Wayne Swan promised no frills, and it is bland and responsible. But it's easy to be fiscally responsible when your economy's Asia's quarry and the world is in the midst of a commodity supercycle. Compared to its mid-year forecasts, the government's looking at raking in $66 billion more in revenue over the next three and a bit years. By the middle of this year, the terms of trade will have risen by 25%, adding $30 billion to national income and more than a few billion to tax revenue. Barring an economic shock that plunges the world into a fresh financial crisis and downturn, the government should have no problems bringing the budget back into balance within a couple of years. You've got to wonder, though, about the economic forecasts, especially for inflation. Treasury only has the consumer price index rising by 2.5% a year, which is less than the Reserve Bank is expecting. It's hard to reconcile that with projections of an economy at full capacity or pretty close to it.
Stephen Long, our economics correspondent. The government's introducing more of the Henry Tax Review recommendations in this budget, with the promise of simplified tax returns and a savings discount. And the Treasurer also announced that the government will provide hundreds of millions of dollars more to bolster its national health plan, with a new 24-hour medical advice hotline and more primary care clinics. But in paying for it, Mr. Swan is also nipping costs in other areas, lowering the childcare rebate cap and tightening up the work test for disability pensioners. Sabra Lane has more.
From 2012, every Australian will have the choice to have an electronic health record. The so-called e-records will contain information about a patient's medical history, what medicines they're taking, including what vaccinations and tests they've had. The measure will cost $466 million over the next 2 years and is designed to make it easier for doctors to share information and to avoid medication mix-ups, which are linked to 190,000 hospital admissions each year. But the government says no one will be forced to have an e-record. They'll be voluntary. The government's announced it's building on its GP superclinic network. It promised 36 of them when it won government, but they've been slow to come online, with only three fully operational. In this budget, the Treasurer is pledging to build another 23 superclinics at yet-to-be-selected sites. But government advisers say they'll be built in areas with doctor shortages. That measure will cost $355 million over 3 years. To ease the pressure in existing doctors' surgeries, practices will be offered payments of up to $25,000 per doctor to hire a registered nurse or a lower amount for an enrolled nurse to carry out basic medical tests and vaccinations to free up doctors to see more serious cases. The government says doctors that employ a nurse see 800 more patients a year than those without extra nursing help. It'll cost the budget bottom line an extra $390 million. But the government says the increases to the tobacco excise, which have already been announced, and changes to the pharmaceutical benefits scheme will help pay for it. On the PBS, the health minister has negotiated a new deal with the pharmaceutical sector, meaning that it'll now see the benefit of price reductions for some medicines, and it argues clearer price transparency, meaning a saving to the budget of $2.5 billion. When it comes to the savings of Australians, the government's delivering on another recommendation from the Henry Tax Review by offering a tax discount for interest earned on money in banks and building societies. From July next year, Australians will receive a 50% discount on up to $1,000 of interest earned, meaning cash in the bank will now be treated the same way as capital gains on assets. For someone earning $40,000 a year who has money in the bank that would earn around $1,000 in interest, that would mean they'd get to keep an extra $177 of it instead of giving it to the tax man. And talking of tax, the government's hinted over the past fortnight that it wanted to deliver simpler tax returns. And Wayne Swan's delivering on that pledge tonight with so-called tick and flick tax returns. From July 2012, taxpayers will have the choice to receive a standard deduction of $500 instead of doing their own tax return and keeping receipts and records. The deduction will go up to $1,000 from July 2013. The government estimates more than 4,500 taxpayers will be better off in the first year of operation. And taxpayers will also get a boost from July this year from the third round of tax cuts initially promised by Peter Costello. For an individual earning $50,000 a year, they'll be $450 better off. But the Finance Minister, Lindsay Tanner's been busy trimming other areas to pay for the budget goodies. From this July, the government is reimposing the annual cap of $7,500 for the childcare rebate and pausing indexation for 4 years. The cap had been $278 higher. It saves the government $86 million over 4 years. And for disability pensioners, the government's tightening up the work test. From July 2012, those pensioners who can't provide sufficient proof from a recognised medical assessor of their inability to work, they'll be taken off the disability support pension and moved to another support payment and offered training to re-enter the workforce. That will provide an extra $383 million over 4 years to the budget bottom line.
Sabra Lane there. And our chief political correspondent, Lyndall Curtis, caught up with the Treasurer, Wayne Swan, in the budget lock-up.
Treasurer, how much of this budget is aimed at keeping Labor's economic management credentials intact?
Well, it's certainly about responsible economics. It's not about politics in particular.
But that does help your political argument, doesn't it?
Well, of course it helps our political argument, but the fact is that the economic cycle exists independently of the political cycle, and the economic cycle globally as well in this country in recent years has been subject to very dramatic changes, and the government responded to those dramatic changes at the height of the global recession and the global financial crisis in a decisive way. And the point I'm making about this budget is we need to do that again to maximise the opportunities that will flow to this country from a return to growth.
You've got some thank you notes to send, though, from this budget, the biggest one to China. Australia would be in something of a hole if not for the resources boom, wouldn't it?
It's not just China. China's an important part of this, but another important part and a more important part was the impact of fiscal stimulus and the response of the Australian people to that. Secondly, the stable nature of our financial institutions and their inherent strength. And, of course, the fact that we are located in that part of the world that is continuing to grow. And China is a significant part of that story, and the China story is a significant part of this budget, which is one of the reasons why the government is so intent upon putting in place policies which deal with commodity boom Mark II. So we don't make the same mistakes that were made by the previous government as commodity boom Mark I moved through our economy.
The mining companies, though, say it's not the time to be taxing them. Do your forecasts for the gains from the mining boom expect investments to boom even with the tax on?
The mining companies will put their own case. The government believes that there is going to be a very strong mining sector in this country for a long time to come. We take very seriously the issues of investment and the tax structures that are required to encourage further investment. We're having a discussion with the mining industry about the fact that the royalty regime doesn't reflect fair value to the Australian people and doesn't, in some cases, encourage mining growth at all. In fact, in many cases, it discourages the growth of the mining industry. We'll get that right. It'll take some time. I don't expect some companies that may pay some more tax to be on the sidelines cheering for this tax, but it's absolutely essential to the future prosperity, not just of the mining industry, but to the country.
The budget documents say, as you've said, that stimulus helped save the economy, but it also says, as you mentioned, the financial sector reforms and flexibility in the labour market, allowing people to step down from full-time to part-time work. Do you also have thank you notes to send to Paul Keating and Peter Costello for those two elements?
Well, the biggest change in the labour market was enterprise bargaining that was put in place by Paul Keating in a former Labor government. That's recognised by everybody and is absolutely fundamental, along with the construction of national superannuation. Two of the great reforms that stand this country in very good stead, both put in place by former Labor governments. They are very important, and that's why we want to build on the superannuation system. That's why that is an integral part of the tax reform proposals I put to the Australian people over a week ago.
You've kept your spending cap 2% on real growth in government spending. and you're keeping that on for longer. Does it show that its budget management is easier in the long term when governments don't spend like drunken sailors?
Oh, well, the previous government always spent like drunken sailors in election year. We're saying that the country cannot afford to have that sort of approach in the circumstances that we are in, and we are putting forward a responsible path for the future.
Does it also show that that is a policy that needs to be continued in the long term, so you can build up surpluses in the good times for the bad times that can't be predicted now?
Well, we do need to come back to surplus, but we also need to be investing in capacity. Because if we don't invest in capacity, we'll make the same mistake that the previous government made, and it starved the productive capacity of the economy, which resulted in inflation that was higher than it should have been. So it's a mix. It's a mix between good, strict fiscal policy on the one hand and making the investments in the productive capacity of the economy.
Your growth forecasts in years 3 and 4 are lower than they were in the mid-year economic outlook. Those forecasts were strongly defended at the time by Treasury. Why have they changed?
Well, because in the meantime, the economy has grown more strongly than was forecast, which means there is less spare capacity in the economy. So that when you adjust your near-term forecasts, it does have an impact on your longer-term forecasts.
Your inflation forecast is also lower than the Reserve Bank's. Are yours simply too optimistic?
I don't debate these matters with the Reserve Bank. I think broadly the forecasts of the government are broadly in line with those of the Reserve Bank. There'll be a difference here and there. I think they're fundamentally quite compatible, actually.
And do you think that, as it was in the global financial crisis, there will be a partnership on inflation with the Reserve Bank? They will hike rates a little bit, but you will be doing some spending to ease those capacity constraints on the other side?
Well, the government is determined to do everything we possibly can to ease capacity constraints in the Australian economy, to put downward pressure on inflation, which is principally the reason that we have moved so swiftly in addressing the issues of a two-speed economy and put in place our tax package only just over a week ago.
You haven't had big spending cuts, but you have taken haircuts along the way through, including freezing the indexation of the childcare rebate. You've also made changes to disability payments. Aren't they small changes, but won't they have a big impact on people?
Well, budget discipline is about making a lot of small changes over a large number of areas, and we have done that in this budget, and there are many more smaller changes in this budget as well. What we have to do is strike the right balance between fairness on the one hand and getting our budget in order on the other, and I believe we've struck that balance.
One area where you have spent some money is on health, on GPs and nurses. You're also promising more GP super clinics, but the ones you've already promised have been slow in being built. Can you deliver on what you've already promised and what you're promising tonight?
Oh, I think the existing commitments are coming along very well. I think over 14 are certainly well advanced. You don't put these things in place overnight, but you do plan for them. The whole point about putting in a plan for health over the next 4 or 5 years is that we don't do what the previous government did, which was to plan for nothing.
You and the Prime Minister keep talking about taking the tough decisions, yet you can't call this a tough budget. There aren't big public sector cuts, there aren't big job cuts or cuts to programs. Are you open to the accusation that you're letting things whirr back into balance and that you haven't had to do much of the heavy lifting at all to make the numbers look good?
I just refute that categorisation as a very big fiscal consolidation, a very large fiscal consolidation, probably the largest since the 1960s. And that has come through a lot of hard work and expenditure restraint. That's important to recognise.
You said this budget was a no-frills budget or a low-frills budget, and there's not a lot of money left in the kitty to spend during an election campaign. Can we expect a low or no-frills election campaign as well?
Well, I didn't deliver this budget to address electoral issues. I delivered this budget on behalf of the government to address the economy, our future growth and opportunities for all Australians, and that's the spirit that's been delivered in.
That was the Treasurer speaking to Lyndall Curtis. Lyndall, the Treasurer was absolutely adamant both there in the interview with you and earlier that this is not an election budget. Do you believe him?
It's not a traditional election budget. There aren't big giveaways and there's no big pot of money left at the end of the rainbow for the government to trawl through for big election promises. But in a lot of ways, this budget, as the Treasurer says, suits the times, but it suits the times for the election as well. The Treasurer seems to be setting up a no-frills or a very low-frills election campaign as well, without many big giveaways. But as I said earlier, making a virtue of the one thing the government seems to have going for it, which is its economic management credentials. The government hasn't slugged ordinary people. It's slugged miners, it's slugged big tobacco, it's slugged pharmaceutical companies, and there's also some measures to claw back from the cash economy. So it's not angering voters, and it's seeking to present a front where it can say, we're doing the responsible thing. We're not going out spending billions and billions of dollars to woo your vote. We will woo your vote by virtue of our prudence.
Yes, I suppose this isn't a typical election budget in that there's not a lot of money being thrown around, but in some ways that's the point, isn't it? I mean, the Treasurer seemed to be already practising his election lines about a choice between an economically responsible government and what he called a risky opposition led by Tony Abbott.
And part of this budget is trying to tie the hands of the opposition as well, because if the government goes out and says, we're not going to spend a lot of money, then that's money that the opposition can't spend either. If the opposition's going to mount an election campaign on debt and deficit and Labor's wasteful spending, they can hardly turn around and promise bucketfuls of money to voters as well. So it's a way that the government tries to reinforce those economic management credentials it has and tie the hands of the opposition at the same time.
Now, the government has been plummeting in the opinion polls, particularly since the Prime Minister ditched the emissions trading scheme. But it was interesting that there was some mention of climate change in the budget, wasn't there?
Well, there was some mention. The government, as expected, is putting more money into renewable energy through one of its favourite mechanisms, through setting up a fund. But it does show that other measures that have taken what the Treasurer has called a haircut have been because there hasn't been a take-up rate. Things like the green cars, there was a rainwater fund. They've had money come out of them because people didn't simply take up what the government was offering. And that partly flows into the government's, the lack of the government's sales abilities, the lack of being able to sell things.
Now, should we be worried about the Treasury getting those numbers so wrong in the last budget?
Well, I think Treasury has historically underestimated the good times and overestimated the bad times. Certainly that's something you'd agree with, Stephen?
Yes, I would say that we shouldn't be worried about Treasury getting the forecasts wrong, because the future is inherently unknowable and you just make a central forecast and then adjust the times. What I would say, though, Eleanor, is that some of the forecasts in this budget are heroic. You have, for example, a forecast that inflation remains at 2.5% throughout the out years in the budget. Now, that is below what the Reserve Bank is predicting. It's predicting that inflation will rise to 3%, and it's hard to see how you're going to get 2.5% inflation with 4% growth, which Treasury is forecasting. And you wonder if inflation does stay at 2.5% in the midst of a mining boom with a massive windfall revenue, whether it does so because interest rates rise sharply. How politically saleable is that? And then we may not get the growth.
Well, Stephen Long, I mean, the Treasurer promised this 2010 budget would be workmanlike and responsible and, in fact, boring. Has he delivered a boring budget?
Indeed he has. I'd say he's over-delivered. It's in many ways a budget that reflects the Treasurer's personality. It's responsible but hardly flamboyant, though, as Lindell said, he's making a virtue of that. And if you recall, in the lead-up to the last election, the government turned things around when it said it wasn't going to engage in a bidding war and it was all about being economically responsible. That's clearly going to be their theme. But that said, you know, how hard has it been for them to be economically responsible? I'm sure that in the expenditure review committee they had to say no to a lot of ministers, but we have the manna from heaven coming through the resources boom. When you look at a $30 billion boost to revenues, that's a huge boost to the tax, and that's this year alone.
How much is the government relying on its resource super profits tax to get the surplus there in the years ahead?
Well, clearly they can't make their offsets, their spending offsets, work without that tax. But on the other hand, they're also cutting the corporate tax rate, and so it swings and roundabouts.
And Stephen, what do you make of the forecasts on economic growth, unemployment and inflation generally? Are they overblown?
Well, I'd certainly say that the forecasts on inflation are things that most economists wouldn't agree with, and the rest of it, it's a wait and see.
Well, now for a news update, here's our political correspondent Louise Yaxley.
The centrepiece of Wayne Swan's budget is a return to surplus 3 years earlier than forecast. He says there'll be a $1 billion budget surplus in 2012-13. Unemployment is on its way down to 4.75%, and economic growth is predicted to be 4% in 2011-12, although inflation is forecast to be steady at 2.5%. The government's strict spending rules mean few new announcements, but there's a promise that in 3 years' time, filing a tax return will be optional. Mr. Swans also announced a new tax discount on bank savings, aimed mostly at helping older people. The budget has a strong focus on health, with more GP super clinics and practice nurses. There's also a skills focus, with 70,000 new training places and support for 22,000 apprentices. The government's third budget is built on the booming economy, new taxes on tobacco and mining profits, and savings in most portfolios.
That was Louise Yaxley there with that news update. Well, joining us now for a closer look at the economics of the budget is Saul Eslake, who's an economist with the Grattan Institute. He's been the ABC's special analyst in the budget lock-up tonight. Now, Saul Eslake, the Treasury didn't get it right last time. How reliable are the predictions about where Australia's economy is heading now, particularly the inflation numbers that Stephen was talking about?
Well, forecasting's a hazardous business, as always. I think it was more hazardous last year when things were changing so quickly and the circumstances had so little recent historical precedent. As the Treasury notes in the budget papers, the forecasts for the international economy actually turned out to be reasonably close to the mark. What Treasury got wrong was the success of the measures which the government and the Reserve Bank undertook to respond to the financial crisis. They produced a better outcome than the government had envisaged. And of course, the other thing that they got wrong was the speed with which China's measures would turn its economy around and boost our commodity prices. I guess in the circumstances, if you're going to make a mistake, it's better to make the kind of mistakes the Treasury did make last year than to have underestimated the severity of the crisis and not done enough in response, which some other governments did do.
Yes, it'll leave yourself with a really big black hole now. But is this earlier than predicted surplus good economic management or good luck? I mean, the Treasury is certainly placing a lot of emphasis on the government's stimulus spending as the key to the recovery.
It's a mixture of both, to be honest. The government certainly is entitled to some of the credit for the better-than-expected performance of the Australian economy. The upward revisions to growth, the downward revisions to unemployment do to some extent reflect the benefits of their stimulus and, of course, the Reserve Bank's cuts in interest rates. Some of the upward revisions to nominal GDP, the gains in the terms of trade, which reflect the stronger-than-expected export commodity prices that Stephen referred to earlier, are, of course, made in China rather than made in either Canberra or Sydney, and the government can't take any credit for them, but it can take credit for applying most of the government's share of those revenues to improving the budget bottom line rather than giving them away in spending cuts, spending increases or tax cuts as the previous government did.
So what is the share there, Saul? We know that there's about $66 billion more in revenue than was forecast at the mid-year economic forecasts. How does that split up between spending or giving the money away to voters and actually putting it to the budget bottom line?
Well, comparing the forecasts for the 4 years to 2012-13 with the forecasts that were in the mid-year review in November last year, the government will collect about $66 billion more in revenue, as you said. They will spend about $24 billion more than they had planned 6 months ago, and the remaining $42 billion has been applied to delivering a better bottom line than had been forecast 6 months ago.
The government's making a virtue out of its spending on infrastructure and skills, but for instance, on universities, they're getting a 1% real increase and they're looking at a massive increase in the number of students. Are they really setting up the economy for future productivity, future growth and developing the nation?
Well, these measures are ones which point in the right direction. But they are also modest, as they needed to be if the government was to stick to the fiscal strategy it had outlined last year. Unless they were prepared to make more swingeing expenditure reductions, which they weren't either in their first budget or in this one, then anything they do by way of targeted initiatives has to be fairly modest, and these were.
Now, let me just interrupt here to introduce Joe Hockey, who's just walked into our studio. What does the opposition make of the 2010 budget? Joe Hockey, thanks for being there. The Treasurer is already using this budget to pitch the government as a responsible economic manager. And I think the words he used about the opposition were the riskiness of the opposition. Is this a responsible budget?
Well, Kevin Rudd and Wayne Swan are asking Australians to trust them, that there will be the biggest improvement in terms of trade in 60 years, to trust them that there will be a massive increase in investment in mining despite a new $9 billion a year tax. Now, the logic of the budget is flawed because they're saying that fewer people are going to smoke with higher taxes on tobacco, but there's going to be a massive increase in investment in mining with a massive increase in taxes on mining. It is illogical. It took Wayne Swan 25 minutes to get the word out. Deficit, $40 billion deficit this year. The government is going to have to borrow $711 million a week to pay for their deficits. They will never deliver a surplus.
Let's say they're delivering a surplus in 3 years. Well, could they do any better?
Yeah, they've never delivered a surplus. They never will deliver a surplus.
Never.
They're trying to claim credit for a surplus they have never delivered. And they're hoping to deliver in 3 years' time.
Is that because you'll block the resources rent tax?
We are totally opposed to a tax that puts a ball and chain around our fastest athlete. You do not speed up the field by handicapping your fastest athlete. What you do is you kill the goose that's laying the golden egg. It was the mining sector that helped to get us through the last downturn, and now they want to harm the mining sector during what could be the growth phase going forward.
You've already said you're going to oppose two of the government's savings measures. One is the resources tax, the other is the private health insurance rebate. Can you go to an election promising to get the deficit down more quickly, and would you have to implement swingeing spending cuts to do that?
Well, the expenditure is reckless. Today, Wayne Swan announced, I think, an extra 23 GP super clinics. Well, of the 36 they've already promised, only two are fully operational.
So you're happy to see that promise
going
go by the wayside?
Promises. They're going and making, we will make announcements about this in the not too distant future. The skills training is simply a rebadge of existing programs. It is not new money.
So on the one hand, you're saying it's not new money, and on the other hand, you're saying it's risky spending.
I'm not saying that. I'm pointing out the flaws in the budget. They're spending nearly $1 billion addressing the problem of asylum seekers. They're spending nearly $1 billion fixing the problem of the pink bats. Kevin Rudd promised that there would be no new bureaucracy for his national health plan, and he's allocating $500 million to a new health bureaucracy. The government can't be believed on anything other than their commitment to spend a lot of money.
Can you, though, get the deficit down quicker, bring the budget
back
into surplus?
Well, we're going to have to, because these guys haven't got the courage to deliver real outcomes.
How would you do it?
They're lacking in courage. They're lacking in ticker. If they can't... I'm confused tonight about whether they are going ahead with an ETS or not. I mean, they were committed, the greatest moral, social, economic challenge of our time a few weeks ago. Then they dumped the ETS, and now they're trying to rebirth it, but they don't want to put it in the budget.
Is there a political problem for you in this budget that the Treasurer says there's not a lot of money left in the kitty for election spending? Are you going to have to go to an election campaign with no frills or low frills as well?
Their budget of getting back to a $1 billion surplus in 3 years assumes that they are not going to make one single new major spending initiative between now and 2014. Do you believe that?
Do you
believe that? We're going to have to take the hard decisions on savings measures. Of course we are.
Now, Joe Hockey, apparently you have to go to your next engagement, but just one very quick question. You say that this Labor government will never bring a budget down that's in surplus. When would you do it?
When we deliver a surplus, which we would want to be faster than when Labor would ever deliver a surplus, we will deliver a real surplus, not one based on false assumptions.
Joe Hockey, thanks very much for joining us. That's the Shadow Treasurer there. And Heather Riddard is the Chief Executive of the Australia Industry Group. She's also a member of the government's Henry Tax Review Panel. Sabra Lane spoke to Ms. Riddard to gauge her reaction to the budget.
It's a cautious budget. It's a credible budget, one that plays to the government's strengths in economic management and in health. And I think the fact that it does return the budget to surplus earlier really does mean the fiscal policy will do its share of the heavy lifting in meeting the increased inflationary pressures and take the pressure off monetary policy going forward.
The government says the economy will pick up because of the commodities boom. It's predicting growth rates of 3.75%, 4%. Did business get enough incentive in this budget to play its part in helping sustain this kind of growth?
Well, I think business will really strongly welcome the skills issues, the three components of it, one around critical skills areas, one around language and literacy and numeracy areas, and the other around reform to the VET system, and all done in partnership with business. So they're very, very, very substantial improvements. Over time, more money will probably be needed, but there's no bigger issue for Australia going in the future than skill shortages. I think areas like exports are underdone. The support for the EMDG scheme and Trade Start is pretty ordinary. I think the R&D area is another area that we continue to lobby the government to put in place a genuinely useful proposal.
Now, putting on your Henry tax review hat, the government's announced in this budget that it's adopted other measures, simpler tax returns, discounts on savings. How much of a difference can those measures make?
Well, they're very important. The discount on savings, at the moment, if you put your money into super or into your house or into shares, you get a capital gains discount, you get a tax concession, you get a range of it. You put it in the bank and you pay tax on the whole lot, even the inflation gains. So it's very distorting. So I'm very pleased. We advocated that hard in the Henry Review. The government have taken a slightly different approach to it, but the principle remains the same. So that's very important. I think the issue of interest withholding tax for foreign banks, etc., I think that's going to be strongly welcomed by those companies. So I think all round a pretty sensible set of measures, and we're building on those reforms. There's 138 in the book, and I think we've probably acted on about six or seven of them by now.
The government's also pushing ahead with another of the recommendations, a 40% tax on so-called super profits. Are you happy with that amount, given the government didn't adopt your other recommendation to drop company tax to 25%?
We are strongly of the view the government should move to reduce the company tax rate to 25%. 28% is simply not enough and doesn't elevate us up the league table enough in terms of being competitive, especially the size of our economy and the headwinds big sectors like manufacturing, tourism, education will face in the years ahead. So we're strongly of the view the government should move faster on that. Resource profits tax, we support the industry in going hard in their negotiations with the government. Conceptually, it's a good tax. Henry recommended it. It's the right way to go to replace the really pretty ordinary royalty system, but they have to get the rules fair and right.
Given that they haven't adopted the 25% corporate tax rate, how much should the government be prepared now to look at for that super profits tax? It said 40%. The industry said we can't sustain that. What do you think the figure should be?
Well, you can model it. I think, I mean, they can do the modelling and you can come up with an exact figure, but it's probably 2.5% or so less than it that's been proposed. But it's not just about the rate. The rate's one issue. It's much more about the rules of transitioning existing projects into it. It's about this so-called uplift factor, how you measure normal profits before you can call them super profits. And getting that right is really fundamentally important. Otherwise, it's not a super profits tax.
That's Heather Ridout, the Chief Executive of the Australian Industry Group, speaking there to Sabra Lane. Well, the nation's peak welfare group, ACOS, was looking for a $45 a week increase in the unemployment payment to help people out of work pay for the higher cost of living. ACOS also wanted a paid work experience scheme for the long-term unemployed. Claire Barton is the Chief Executive of the Australian Council of Social Service, and she joins us now in the studio, along with political correspondent Alexandra Kirk. Claire Martin, was this budget generous enough to the Australians that you represent?
For low-income Australians, the surplus is an excellent kind of outcome. Primary healthcare investment, again, going with the other investment we've seen in health over the last month, $2.2 billion today on primary healthcare, great for access to GPs, access to nurses in the future. That's an excellent outcome for low-income Australians. Making tax simple is good. Investment in some of the skills we need for the future, for jobs. Again, good outcomes for low-income Australians. The big missing, as you said in your introduction, is that for our unemployed and often long-term unemployed, really nothing much in this budget. No transition to work schemes that really are needed if you're long-term unemployed, and still left on that miserable $33 a day to survive while they look for work.
Did that surprise you?
Look, I'm always an optimist, and I hope that when we saw the pension increase last year, which was great for the pensioners, that gap of $120 a week would actually be kind of closed in this budget. But, you know, $33 a week, a day is really hard to survive on, and we are keeping a lot of Australians very poor.
Claire, can you understand, to keep the pressure off interest rates, the government needed to hang on to as much revenue as possible to get the budget back into surplus as fast as humanly possible?
I can understand that, and certainly, you know, from low-income Australian point of view, great to see that we'll be in surplus much quicker than we thought we would be. You know, we must have a sustainable budget. But in all the expenditure that we've seen, we've got to make an investment in Australians without jobs. And to say to people, you can just simply survive on that very low New Start payment, is not Australian. It's not fair. And $33 a week, we can do better.
There's still 600,000 people who are without a job. The Treasurer said tonight that he expects unemployment to fall to 4.75% by 2012. He regards that as full employment. That's around 500,000 people. Are you comfortable with that?
No. And Australia should not be comfortable with a figure like that. We know that we've got a group now of long-term unemployed, probably 2 years or more unemployed, and that's about 350,000 right now. And we simply can't say to those people, well, I'm sorry, you're out of the workforce. As we saw after the last recession in the early 90s, we saw a growth in unemployment of about 200,000 Australians, and it took us a decade to get it down. We really need to tackle that, and we need effective transition to work programs, and we need to make sure while people are unemployed, for whatever reason that is, that they're not going backwards, and they are now.
You argued for paid work experience. The government has instead put up $600 million for a new skills package. There's extra training places to fill the shortage, the work shortage, the skill shortage in hotspots, and an extra 70,000, an extra 22,000 apprenticeships over the next 6 months. Is that what you wanted?
I welcome the investment in skills. We know we need that for the future. But you can't make that investment in skills at the expense of other Australians who need to have those transition to work, that kind of paid work experience. We need to do two things. We can't just invest in skills and ignore those Australians who we really need to assist get into the workforce.
And Claire Martin, just briefly, you're a former politician and former Labor politician in the Northern Territory. Now, the Treasurer says this isn't a budget about politics, even though it is an election year budget. Do you believe him?
This is a very fiscally cautious budget, Eleanor, and certainly, you know, give praise to the government for that. And taking the position of cautious fiscal budget is political. Everything a politician does is political.
Thanks very much, Claire Martin, the Chief Executive of ACOS, and Alexandra Kirk, there, our political correspondent. Well, as we've been hearing, the government is using this budget to try to show voters that it's a sound economic manager. But is the message getting through to undecided voters? Paul Riley is a mechanical engineer living in southwest Sydney. He voted Labor at the last election, but doesn't know yet who he'll be supporting next time. PM's Meredith Griffiths watched the budget speech with Paul Riley and his wife Marina at their home in Revesby.
There's still a fair bit of spending in the budget, it seems. So it's pleasing that it looks like a return to surplus early, but it seems that's not driven by a reduction in spending. It's by an increasing in tax. So I'm a little worried about that. These taxes may not eventuate, or they may not be as lucrative as the government may think.
I don't think it's going to benefit the working people very much at all. I just think that with the way interest rates are increasing, the cost of mortgages has gone up by more than $50, $100 a month, depending on how much you're paying. And basically the workers are only going to get less than $10 a week. It's just going to counteract each other. It's not going to make much difference at all.
What do you think of what the government has offered you tonight?
Well, we have to be thankful for all income tax cuts, I guess. The increase in tobacco tax is going to really affect those people who smoke, of course, but I think it's a positive thing. So there's a good contribution to the budget from that. I'm just a little worried again about taxing mining too heavily.
What are your concerns there?
Well, that it may make Australia uncompetitive in the mining sector. I'm not sure that the same sort of taxation regime applies to Brazil and the other countries that would supply resources to China.
Are you pleased with the level of spending that the Treasurer has outlined tonight?
Only if the taxes are viable. I think I'd be happy if they had cut some programs. Yeah.
Do you think that your family will take up this offer of the simplified tax returns?
Yes, I think so. We had an investment property, but we don't have one now, so I think our tax return is fairly simple, so I think that would be a good idea.
Wayne Swan spoke a bit about the ageing population and managing that. Do you think that he is taking the right steps towards Australia moving comfortably forward into the future?
Yeah, I think the drawing some more money into super is a very good idea. We need to provide for the future as the baby boomers age, I guess. So it's essential.
So Kevin Rudd has been putting the case that his government are sound economic managers. After watching this budget tonight, are you convinced by that message?
Well, I think they're probably sweating a little bit and hoping that the mining tax is viable. I think it all pretty much hinges around the revenue they're going to get from that. So it'll be a good move in hindsight if they prove to be viable. If they don't, then I think it'll unravel.
That's Paul Riley, a swinging voter from Revesby in Sydney, speaking to Meredith Griffiths. So despite what the Treasurer says about this being a non-political budget, it is an election year and this budget is clearly going to shape the campaign. Joining me now to talk about this is Brian Toohey from the Financial Review, Saul Eslake from the Grattan Institute, and our own Chief Political Correspondent Lyndall Curtis and Stephen Long, our Economics Correspondent. Well, we heard Joe Hockey earlier there talking about his reaction. He seemed to be saying this was mostly an irresponsible budget. Brian Toohey, what's your take on what Joe Hockey had to say?
Well, we are going to, unless something terrible happens, the government will certainly achieve a budget surplus. All that has to happen is that revenue keeps growing at a reasonable rate, and they have shown that they can control government spending or keep government spending overall below 2%. And the other thing which I find very hard about the opposition, I don't know how they can keep going with this campaign about government debt is terrible and we're in awful trouble because of government debt. There's figures in the charts in the budget paper showing that you can hardly see the Australian level of debt on the graph. But we are minuscule. We will peak at about 6% of GDP, and the average for the main advanced economies is well over 60%, so well over 10 times that, and many are above 100%. So Australia is incredibly well positioned there. I would argue that it is wrong to aim for zero debt. Actually, some modest level of debt is worth having if you put it into productive investment. For the opposition to be banging on about debt, I think is a dead-end street for them.
And you almost seem to be suggesting, though, that it's automatic that the government would go into surplus, that it's not a great achievement to have...
Look, there is a good achievement here. This is a good outcome. The government has got unemployment's going to come down well. Growth in the economy is going up, and that there's just no gainsaying now that outcome. But the part of that is to do, obviously, with the renewed resources boom that was underway already. But there's a tremendous things that depends on that, and that is they cannot get the revenue from the resources tax unless the boom keeps going, yet they have already spent that money. They're spending about $9 billion. They committed out of the resources tax, which will bring in about $9 billion, they've committed all of that money and more, the great bulk of it being on the cost of the tax concessions from lifting compulsory superannuation contributions, from 9% of salaries to 12%.
Is that responsible?
I don't like it at all. I'll tell you why. I think that... One reason is that I don't like forcing people to put more of their money into a particular thing. Most people will have more money to live on in their retirement, or almost more, than they have while working, which I think is silly. But worst, it hardly does anything to boost savings, which is the great claim. There are figures in the budget papers, tucked away in the budget papers, showing that after this has been in place for a long while, 2035, it will lift savings as a percentage of GDP by 0.4% of GDP, when savings at the moment are about 22% of GDP. So it's almost no change for an immense cost. The cost of the tax concessions when they are fully in, and a couple of other related changes on super, $8 billion a year.
Now, Stephen Long, we didn't hear Joe Hockey's view on the superannuation issue that Brian's just raised, but what was your view on his response to the resources tax?
Joe Hockey is arguing that this will kill the golden goose. Well, if you look at what's happened with commodity prices, Eleanor, it's very, very hard to see that miners would follow through with threats not to invest or cut production. You've had, on the Reserve Bank's figures, a 25% increase in commodity prices over the past 3 months. You've had a 70% increase in the spot prices for iron ore this year, a 35% increase in the spot prices for coke and coal. So the prices are booming, demand is booming, and the government is looking to get a share of that, and the mining industry will keep on mining, that's for sure. On the superannuation issue, I think that Brian Toohey is raising a very fair point. The average return, the compound return on superannuation in Australia over the 13 years to 2009 was 3% a year. That's barely ahead of the inflation rate. Why would you be giving this industry more money? And when you look at the tax breaks that are being offered, particularly to high-income earners, it helps explain some of the issues that ACOS was raising, why we can't raise the living standards of the unemployed, why we can't adequately fund higher education.
And that does also go to one of the other things about this government, that it always says it will take tough decisions, but it hasn't really done anything to reduce the middle-class welfare. It's not taking decisions which really hurt people in this budget, and it hasn't done in the budgets it's put in place. It is, you know, riding a mining boom, as Peter Costello did, but it also has some upside risks that may hurt people, and that's if the inflation forecasts blow out, then people will end up paying higher interest rates. And it may be after the next election that the government has to look at the sort of tough decisions it prides itself on taking now.
Saul, it's like we haven't actually heard a lot of criticism of the superannuation policy. It's been reasonably well received. What is your take on it?
Well, I think the government has gone in the opposite direction to that which the Henry Review recommended, which was to some extent along the lines that Brian and Stephen have been talking about reducing the extent to which superannuation savings by high-income earners in particular enjoy substantial, though largely hidden, support in the form of tax concessions. What the government has done in this budget, which I think is worth noting, is the decision to even out a bit the tax treatment of savings through bank deposits in the form of interest income, which have been the most onerously taxed form of saving until this decision has come into effect. Now, as a result of it, people with savings of up to about $20,000 at current interest rates will in effect enjoy the same tax treatment of the income from that source as people who have been getting it on capital gains for the best part of a decade.
Will that make much difference, though, to saving levels?
It ought to make a bit of a difference. Obviously, to the extent that people are saving to achieve a particular income level, then paying less tax on it might allow them to get away with saving less. But I think most people are target saving. Certainly those who are saving to acquire a deposit on a home, for example, will, I think, be encouraged to save more as a result of this decision. And as I say, in the sense that lower income earners are more likely to have more of what savings they have in the form of bank deposits rather than more sophisticated products, then it can be defended as an equity measure as well.
Sorry, go Brian.
They do say, however, in their propaganda here that it will be particular benefits for older people. It will be no benefit for them. Rich or poor, almost no people who are old in Australia pay tax. So getting a tax concession on your savings means nothing to these people.
I agree with that, but it is a measure that makes sense in economic terms and equity terms.
Which is?
This measure to basically allow people to have money in a savings account and have a 50% reduction in the tax they'd pay on their marginal tax rate on the interest. Now, that's up to $1,000 in interest. Well, you've got to have $20,000 in the bank to be making $1,000 in interest per annum. And so this will cover a lot of people, and it is a good incentive for saving, and it will help low and middle income earners. But they're not winding back on the capital gains tax concessions or the concessions for negative gearing of rental property, which have distorted the market. And the Henry Review came up with a proposition that would have wound back on those concessions, which overwhelmingly benefit high-income earners and direct savings to areas of the economy which aren't overly productive, and would have helped low-income earners, and it was rejected by the government.
Brian Toohey, is this a budget that's built of brave decisions?
No, look, on the other hand, you shouldn't probably expect brave decisions on the eve of an election. On the other hand...
Oh, Brian, this is not an election budget.
Right. Well, I mean, it is not outrageous in terms of trying to buy votes, like some of the John Howard pre-election budgets were. So, look, to be fair to the government, you might say it wasn't brave, but on the other hand, they didn't do anything wild in an attempt to win votes.
Yeah, I think that's right. If you look at the tables in this budget, they show that there are net policy decisions putting $7.5 billion or so into the economy. That is, they've spent or cut taxes by about $7.5 billion more than they've reduced spending and increased taxes. The last two pre-election budgets of the Howard government put $36 billion and $50 billion respectively over the following 4 years in the lead up to the election. And so by those standards, this is a very cautious budget for a pre-election period.
So Lindell, we're all fiscally conservative Keynesians now.
Lindell, just briefly, will this budget swing the polls even though the Treasurer says it's not meant to?
Well, it depends. Hopefully it will for Labor. Labor will be hoping it keeps a hold of its economic management credentials. The interesting thing will be to see how the opposition responds to it, because a lot of these measures are after the election. The resources tax will come in after the election. So the fight will still be over the ideas of what's in this budget rather than what's in Parliament through legislation. And it will be interesting to see how the opposition deals with the question of getting the deficit down faster, whether it will go to tougher spending cuts.
Lindell Curtis, Stephen Long, Brian Toohey and Saul Lislake, thanks very much for joining us for this budget special. And that's it for Budget 2010. I'm Eleanor Hall. Thanks for being with me tonight, and enjoy the rest of your evening.